Welcome to Rails with Jason. If you enjoyed today's episode and want more Rails tips and advice, head over to codewithjason.com, where I keep all my Rails articles and videos. Now on to the episode. Welcome to Rails with Jason, and welcome to the first episode of 2020. I'm here today with my guest, Jessica Kerr, better known as Jessitron. Jessica, welcome to the show.
Thank you, Jason.
Jessica, for those of them, whoever, who aren't familiar with you, can you introduce yourself?
Oh, sure. I've been a software developer for 20 years now, and I also speak at conferences. And in going to conferences and working in different teams, I've come to decide that software development is both the hardest and the most fascinating field that we have today, because it's so new and we don't know how to do it yet. Not right, if there really is a right. And it's so powerful. We can do things with software at a speed and an impact that no other material gives us.
Yeah, it is really interesting because I've worked with computers basically my whole life. And so I'm quite familiar with computers, and it feels to me like it's been around for a long time because it was kind of there when I was born. But relatively speaking, it's a really young field, compare it to medicine or civil engineering or a lot of other things. It pretty much just started relatively. And like you said, we're still figuring it out.
Yeah, we're still figuring it out. And I think software grows at a faster pace as a field because every 5 years almost, certainly every 10 years, it's a completely different field because we're working on top of languages and build tools and ecosystems and services that the previous 10 years built. So it's we're working in a different level of reality every decade or so. So the field, it's young and it changes super fast.
Yeah. Changes famously fast. I remember there was this one Onion newspaper I got when they still, maybe they still do, but when they had the paper versions of the Onion, and I picked one up.
Ooh, paper and Onion.
And it was it was a technology issue. It said the already obsolete technology issue was the headline. I really enjoyed that. So Jessica, you spoke recently at RubyConf in Nashville. That was November, right?
Right.
And in your talk, I watched, I cyberstalk all of my guests before we talk. And so I was watching parts of your talk, and you were talking, among other things, about working with large systems that are too big to fit into one person's head. And I think it's probably true that a system doesn't even have to be, you get to that point pretty fast when the system is so big that one person can't remember it all. I've been working on an application for the last 16 months. I've been the only person working on it the whole time. This is actually really funny. I was talking with a user of the system the other day, and I asked him a question about how did you know such and such thing? And they're like, oh, I looked at page X, and I had completely forgotten that page X even existed. I'm like, wow. Oh, now I understand this whole picture so much differently because I forgot about this thing that I made not that long ago. So you get to that point pretty quick.
Really good example.
Just to kind of tee up this topic, I don't know where to start, but what should people know about working with systems at large?
Well, if you're a professional software developer working at a company, you probably already work on a system that doesn't fit in your head. The first thing to know about it is it's not you. You're not stupid. And you're never going to know it all, and you shouldn't know it all, and that's not expected of you. And if someone does expect it of you, then they have problems. Because even if you wrote the system, and that's like the easiest case, is the one where you created it, so you got to build up your mental model of the system as you were going. And even then, we have to let parts of it fall out of our brain in order to build new parts. One of the hardest parts of learning is forgetting. And I'm really good at forgetting. That's one reason I learn a lot. That's my theory. Yeah.
Same here.
Yeah. So we have, whatever. We try to build systems, not that we can remember, but that we can come back to and find out what we need to know quickly. That's one reason we focus so much on readable code, because we can't stay in sync mentally with the code all the time. We always have to come back to it and figure it out. But the code is only just like one clue, and it's not always the clue that gives us the best perspective. Just one clue to how the system is working.
Okay. The first thing I'm curious about is this. Do you feel like everything should be like, do you feel like there should just be the code and no external documentation? Or do you think that, like, I don't know, like I've worked somewhere where we kept a bunch of documentation in Confluence because we felt like the code wasn't enough. So we had these external docs. But that wasn't perfect either, because then the docs would get out of sync with the code and the docs would get out of sync with other docs and stuff like that. So how do you look at that whole thing?
Documentation is not our answer. Well, first of all, if you're keeping your documentation separately from the code and it doesn't share a commit history, then you can't, just don't even bother. Then you can't correlate how old the documentation is, at least with a commit history. You can tell that it was maybe possibly accurate at the last point in time it was changed. But documentation isn't going to do it. What I think really helps is systems that explain themselves as they're running. So I would propose really good admin screens. The operator interface for you. Now, this is given that you're operating the software that you wrote, and if you're not, I don't know if I can help you. But when we're operating the software that we care for, we can make screens for ourselves that explain to us what's going on. And that can give us insight into what's happening at runtime and what fits together. And that is where I put that information. Inside the running application.
Okay. And I can kind of see the benefits of that. Like you said, if you have documentation that doesn't have a commit history, then you don't really know, like, when is this documentation? Because, like, truth has kind of a time component to it, you know?
Totally, yeah.
Yeah, so, like, just because something was true at one point in time doesn't mean it's necessarily true now. And if you don't have the commit history, then you have to wonder, is this still true, or was it only true at one point in time and now it's not anymore?
Right. Yeah, I love commit messages. I love to put information there because it's always accurate, and it's accurate forever for the commit it's talking about.
Mm. Can we talk? Let's zoom in on that for just a second. I've worked with programmers in the past who will just put commit messages like did stuff, worked on thing. Like, it's really, they don't think it's important to put a meaningful commit message. I would suspect that you don't agree with that.
You know, I totally think those are very fine commit messages for a one line change.
Hmm.
If you changed one line of code and there's no point reiterating because you can read the diff as fast as you can read the commit message, yeah, fix the thing. Wasn't used. to do is done. Back from lunch. I mean, whatever. But as soon as you can't see at a glance what's happening, as soon as the commit diff crosses multiple files, put the why in there. You know, it's better than comments because it doesn't hang around in the code after it's no longer accurate. And it gives people insight into what's happening.
Here's what I think. I just put this together just now. Here's what I think the problem is with the people who put the like meaningless commit messages in. Mm-hmm. I think they fail to realize that a commit is not just like a mechanical part of doing your work. Mm. A commit is a piece of communication.
Mm. Right. That is why we put it in version control.
Yeah. I mean, obviously there's like the mechanical, like you need to roll something back maybe, or you need to like do a bisect and find where a bug was introduced. But also like when you're doing a bisect, for example, and you're looking through the various commits, it's helpful for each commit to be an atomic unit of work with a description so that you can look at it and say like, oh, I see what this is, so that when you're, I don't know, trying to find what the bug is or like deciding whether to roll something back or something like that, mm-hmm. it's much easier when it's meaningful.
Yes. Yeah. Yeah. A commit message is a way to give our future selves a communication line to our past selves, the self we are now. But it's hard. So one reason that we throw out crappy commit messages is because stating our intentions in words is hard. I mean, especially as an expert, when you just start in the flow of refactoring or reformatting or cleaning up some code or making the change, you like have a feeling for what you're doing, and turning that into words is non-trivial. It takes brain power. But this is another reason I love pairing, because again, it forces us to put our intentions into words. And when we do that, it's almost like writing the test and writing the code. You're stating what you're doing in another way. And that often triggers your brain to notice discrepancies and notice things you're missing.
That's so interesting that you say that. I mentioned to, I think it was my father-in-law once, that I don't typically think in words. Mm. And I could tell that he thought that was like the most bizarre thing in the world. But you seem to probably get what I mean, because you're totally right. When you're coding, you're not really thinking in words. I don't know what you're thinking in, but it's not words, at least not for me. And then when you need to like articulate it to somebody, there's like a translation step. And I think what you're saying, tell me if I'm understanding this right, is like there's value in that step of translating what you're doing in the code into words. Is that it?
It engages another part of your brain. A couple different parts. It engages the language centers that are formulating this intention, and writing light code, writing complete sentences forces you to get more specific and rigorous with your thinking. Writing code forces you to get rigorous in a whole nother way. But if you do both, that engages more of your brain. And then also you see the words with your eyes, and then your visual input comes back. And generally, like, more of you is engaged and able to find problems. And if you have another person, even better, that you're articulating it to, like a pair, even better, because then they reflect that back. And this is how we get more things right, just by broadening our interactions with it.
That's really interesting, because like your different parts of your brain have different strengths and weaknesses. They're good at different stuff. And if you bring more parts of your brain into the mix, it's more likely that you'll cover more stuff.
Yes, totally. Sometimes when I'm working alone and I don't have a pair, but I'm working on something open source, I'll stream on Twitch. Mm. because that way I'm forced to put things into words and explain what I'm doing, which forces me to like follow a coherent path of changes and like really have a reason for everything I'm doing. I need to express my hypothesis of what I think is going to happen when I push run on these tests, and then express what I want to be different, and then change the code, and then say what I think is going to happen and see whether it does. And this really, it keeps my brain in this more scientific mode of say what you expect, test it on the world, observe whether you were surprised.
Ooh, I think what you just said is so important. And a lot of people don't get this based on like, when I teach classes and observe students and like just work with coworkers and stuff like that, I think I see a lot of people like getting this part wrong, which is like, okay, you just talked about, I think you said like you might form a hypothesis about what's going to happen when you run certain tests, and then you observe what happens, and you use the word scientific. I've often worked with somebody, and I like to ask this question as a test. They'll make a change and I'll say, okay, do you expect it's going to work now? And they'll be like, yeah. And I think it's the wrong thing to have an expectation, and especially having an expectation that it's going to work. Whenever I make any change, I never say that I expect it's going to work now. All I say is I made a change, and maybe I have like a mental hypothesis that, okay, maybe it'll work now. But I think it's like a nuanced but important distinction between having an expectation and having a hypothesis about what's going to happen.
That's an interesting point, because expectations are dangerous in life, largely because we almost always see what we expect to see. And so you said they expect it to work now, and sometimes you'll see something and you'll be like, oh, it's working. Is that really what you wanted it to do? Because if you didn't state beforehand what you wanted it to do, what is the definition of working? You're tempted to take, well, I typed this one thing and it worked. Or I typed this and then nothing happened, but then I pushed enter and then it happened. Okay, that must be working.
Yeah. Yeah. Like, what's your definition of it works, and how do you verify that it works?
Yeah. Yeah. And when you put that in words, it starts to be like, oh, you start to realize, oh yeah, the user shouldn't have to push enter. When they type the 2-digit year, it should just work or whatever. And then you might notice these things. Now, expectations are kind of evil. They trip you up in life too, if they're not stated, because then you start having unstated expectations of, say, your spouse of, I thought for sure they would empty the dishwasher. But if you didn't tell them that the dishwasher needed emptied, why should they know? Anyway, expectations are kind of the devil. But hypotheses are a different thing, because you state them before. Also, it's kind of like, I never trust a test that I haven't seen fail. You need to see the red test, then make the change, then see the green test. Otherwise, you might have just asserted true. It's the same thing.
Sorry, can you explain that more?
Oh, sure. Okay, so in test-driven development, when you're writing your test and then you make the test pass, don't forget to see the test fail. You write the test and then you should have a hypothesis that the test will not work. So in that sense, you're kind of testing your test, making sure that it doesn't work before you implement your change. If you implement the change and the code and then run the test and it passes, maybe you're asserting true in your test.
Yeah. Yeah, and another way to put that is like, I'll say it like this. I am constantly surprised by the high percentage of the time that I write a test and it either passes when it's not supposed to pass or it fails in a way that's different from the way I expect it to fail.
Way. That's a great point. And there's a point. If you just expect it to fail and it fails, you might just move on. But it's important that it fail in the specific way that you expect it to fail. Because if it fails in some other way, then you have a discrepancy with your understanding. You don't understand how the system works as well as you thought you did. And that's a valuable piece of information that lets you go learn something.
Okay, so one characteristic of this show that the listener will know if they've listened to more than three episodes is I don't value staying on topic at all, and I drag us down rabbit holes constantly. So now I'm going to ask you a completely different question now that we're on this topic of testing, which I like to talk about a lot. And with that little preamble, I forgot what I was even going to ask. But we're talking about testing, writing your failing test before you make it pass. I completely don't remember. So I'll ask a different question, I remembered it. Okay. What percentage of the time would you say that you do test-driven development? And how do you think about test-driven development versus not test-driven development?
Test-driven development is one tool, and I do it often, but definitely not all the time. Sometimes I'm exploring. For instance, if I'm messing around with the UI, I'm definitely not doing test-driven development because I don't know what I want to see yet.
Yeah. I think about it the exact same way, and I don't think I've ever heard anybody else say that, but I think about that the exact same.
Mm. Right. So I kind of divide development into a couple things. There's things that I know I want to do, and if I know exactly what the code should do, once I get to that point, test-driven development is a great idea. And in fact, that's one of the reasons to do test-driven development is it drives you to think about, okay, what exactly do I want this to do? You have to express your hypothesis in the test. But before that, when I'm figuring out what might work, then I'm in an exploratory phase. And I don't expect to be able to reproduce anything that I do in the exploratory phase. I just want to futz around and then forget everything. Usually I'll do.
Can you talk more about that?
Sure. In the UI, it's straightforward. I know I want it to look different, but I don't know what I want to look like, So I might open the Chrome Dev Tools and start changing the styles or just changing the elements themselves in the page. And I know that's ephemeral. I know it's going to go away as soon as I hit refresh. But what matters is that I learned something. And then anything that I want to keep, I'll go put in the code, and then I'll hit refresh, and then I'll see if it looks right, and so on. And for UI, that's probably all I'm going to do, because what it looks like is its meaning. But then when I'm working on some business logic, if I'm writing a function or a class, I might futz around with it for a bit to see how the types work out if I'm in TypeScript and what it looks like to write the functionality in a couple of different designs, whether it's a function or as a class. And then I'm going to do git checkout dot, wipe all that out, and then write the tests.
Let me stop you there. How long do you think you might spend in that phase where you're just messing around between the time you start and the time you blow it away and start for real?
Yeah, it's not very much. It's probably 10 minutes max. Because then also I'll futz around in the tests and sometimes wipe them out because the tests are expressing the API and they express how to use the API, which is the important part. And I usually want that to be the cleanest.
Yeah. And I asked about that because I think you're touching on something really important, which is that to me, okay, so I used to think code was mainly how do I word it? It's not just a tool for getting work done. It's also a medium for thinking.
Yes. Yes, it is. Yeah. So that whole exploratory bit is about thinking. It's about thinking, because our job is making decisions. That's the hard part. And so we futz around with it until we've made a decision about what to do. And then you want to encode that in a test that keeps it solid. Because the thing about tests is that they prevent change.
Yeah.
That's their job.
And I just want to add that I do the exact same thing myself. I will like, so the way I think about it is like, okay, so first, if I'm approaching something and I know exactly how I want to do it, like I'll just do it. But if there's quite a bit of the time, it's something that I don't know exactly. Not only do I not know how I want to do it, but I'm not even sure what I want to do. Yeah. And so in those cases, I'll give myself permission to like, I'll give myself permission to not write tests, give myself permission to write the crappiest code I want to, and I'll just mess around. And it's all okay, because I'm probably not going to commit any of that. And you have to, as part of that, you have to have the discipline to not, like, at the end of it, say, like, oh, well, I'll just actually commit it anyway. You have to have the discipline to actually blow it away and start over. But, yeah, I do the same thing.
You'll do it better the second time.
Yeah.
I was looking for examples of waste. And one thing that we feel like wasting is, well, we have working code. Why delete it? We need to save this somewhere. No, you don't. You now know what you want to do, and you know at least one way to make it work. And that is the value you've got out of this exploration. It is not wasteful to write it again, because the second time you write it, you're writing it in a readable way. You're writing it in a way that's going to make sense to you later. You're writing it with a broader perspective of not just, can I get this to work? Because you know you can get it to work. You get to think, is future me going to be able to understand this? Am I going to be able to write a coherent commit message about this?
Okay. So you talked about like that phase where it might be exploratory. Then when you're actually writing your tests, how do you approach that? I've seen some people like they'll maybe write like 4 or 5, like what's the word for this? What's that?
Example tests?
Yeah, I was thinking specifically of the part like if you're in RSpec and if you're saying like it and then in quotes, blah, 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 do. What's the name for that thing in quotes? I don't know what it is.
The should phrase? Yeah.
So if we call it the should phrase, some people will write like 4 or 5 of those all at the beginning and then like go one by one and make each one pass. Sometimes I do that. Sometimes I don't do that. But how do you approach that? Just like, what's your process for writing tests?
Let's see. I will often write 5 or 6 it statements and let them be pending. It's a matter of how well do I understand the problem. Because when I think of one of those, I don't want to have to remember it. Type it, get it out onto the screen so that I can forget it and focus on the one I'm implementing.
Yeah.
Other times I feel the need to implement like the corner case first or the zero case, whatever the simplest thing is, and then think about what it should do next.
And then inside the test, I'll share how I do it. And then I'm curious how you do it. So I trust myself very little. So I write as little code as possible at a time. So I will like, let's say I'm writing a feature spec where I need to like visit a page and fill out a form and hit enter. And feel free to interrupt me at any point if you want to. But I will write the line that says visit the page and then I'll run just that much. I know it's like useless at that point because all it does is visit the page, but I'm just making sure I didn't make a mistake with that.
Yeah, you have a hypothesis. You have actually. So when you do that, when you run that test, you are testing your hypothesis because you have a hypothesis that when you say visit the page, it will do that and it won't fail. Right?
Yeah.
Right. But if you don't run that test, if you just keep going and add a bunch of more stuff, then you have an unstated expectation.
And I'm setting myself up for disappointment.
Yes, you've assumed that worked. And so when you get a surprise, it will be an unhappy surprise. Whereas when you keep it so small like that, when you get a surprise, you're like, huh. And it feels more like an opportunity for learning than a step backwards.
Yeah. Yeah. So that's how I do it. And I just go one single line at a time. And it might be kind of inefficient to do it that way. But actually, I think it's on balance, it's more efficient, I think, because the alternative is sometimes you write a whole bunch of stuff and it doesn't work. And it takes so much longer to fix something that, like, where there's some bulk of code and something's wrong with it. It takes so much longer to fix that than to fix the most recent one line you added.
I just wrote a blog post yesterday about this kind of thing, but with laundry. That thing that you feel is inefficient is actually faster because you're learning more quickly. You have a shorter learning loop. Mm. If you were doing the same thing over and over, that's when efficiency matters. That's when you can be efficient because you already know how to do this thing. And so you can start slimming it down. But when we're doing something new, which hopefully in software we're doing all the time, because if you're doing the same thing over and over again, automate that stuff. So when you do that one thing at a time, you're not leaving a bunch of work in progress, untested stuff. You're learning as quickly as you can.
Yeah.
And slow is smooth and smooth is fast.
Wait, slow is smooth. Can you say that again?
Yeah. Slow is smooth and smooth is fast. I think this comes from Leonard DevOps or something, right? Because when you do it slowly, it's more smooth in the sense of when you hit a bump, it's a pothole, not a chasm.
Yeah.
You know exactly where the problem is. It's right there in front of you. You weren't going so fast that you like drove your car into the ditch.
I mixed myself up because I say something to myself sometimes, which is, well, I read this passage in a book that was like, it said with people, the fast way is the slow way and the slow way is the fast way. And so I was trying to map that to slow is smooth and smooth is fast. And I'm like,
yeah,
wait a second.
It is the same thing. Yeah. With the mediator. The mediator is smoothness there. Slow causes fast through the mediator of smooth.
Exactly. okay. So talking about like hypotheses and science and all that stuff, would you happen to have read the book Zen and the Art of Motorcycle Maintenance?
I have not yet.
I highly recommend it. There's a part in there where it talks. Okay. So the book is like this, it's a novel about this guy and his son, and they ride their motorcycles across the US. And there's like little asides through all of it about philosophy and the mechanics of motorcycles and some other stuff. And there was one part of it. I actually want to turn this into a conference talk sometime because I think it's so great. It talked about, let's say your motorcycle has a misfire. I don't know anything about motorcycles or cars or anything, but I don't know if that's right. But let's say your motorcycle has a misfire.
And so it's like make it puh sound.
Yeah. And you, or no, I remember what it was. It was your motorcycle won't start. And you suspect that it's something with the electrical system. You don't know it's something with the electrical system. You just suspect it's something with the electrical system. And what the author said was, don't write down problem, motorcycle's electrical system doesn't work, because you don't know for a fact
that
that's true. Yeah. So it's better to write down problem, cycle won't start, even though that sounds dumb. It's better just to write down what you know for an absolute fact. And like when I read that and when I thought about that in relation to programming, it made me think of like, so programmers tend to be like super smart, analytical people. And yet I see, and I'm sure you see a lot, programmers failing to think scientifically. Have you seen that? And like, what thoughts do you have on that?
I have seen it some, and I think like my college degree was in physics. And I think that's the one thing that like really helped was I always approached programming with the scientific method. In fact, one of the reasons I chose to go into programming instead of staying in physics was that physics got all vague on me with quantum mechanics and stuff. And now you can't predict everything perfectly. And what fun is that? In programming, you can at the small, like in a small scale when you're writing functions. So like, you know, my first several years in programming, things could be very predictable. And you can run those sort of tests. You can make a hypothesis, see it not work, change something, see it work, know that your change had that effect. Very gratifying. But yes, part of the problem is that we are really smart. And when you're really smart, you want to hold a bunch of things in your head because you can. And then you want to get all those things out into the test before you run it. And then you wind up with failures that you can't diagnose, or at least that you can't diagnose as quickly as you could if you weren't trying to be smart. Some days I do my best code when I'm sick because I have to do it slowly. I have to do it a tiny step at a time because my brain is only at like 75%. But what comes out, it works. And because I'm not thinking too far ahead, I'm just thinking about this one bit. You said something interesting earlier. You said, I trust myself very little, so I write very little code at a time. And we opened the show saying that we wanted to talk about how to work on systems that are really big, that don't fit in your head all at once. One way to work with a complex system when you're changing it is to make the changes as simple as possible, like disgustingly simple. Like, what is the smallest change you can make that will still run? I want to extract a function. Okay, I made a new function. It runs. Okay, I filled in the body of this function. It runs. Okay, now I'm actually going to call that function. It runs. The smaller the changes we can make, the bigger the systems we can make them to.
Yeah, I would agree. And here's an example of how I work in that way that I know won't surprise you, Jessica, but might surprise some people listening, which is like, it's not uncommon at all for me to make a one-line change, commit it, and then deploy it and verify it in production. Just one line, put it through the whole cycle.
That reassures you that the whole cycle is working, and then you can make your next change with more confidence.
Yeah. And I was maybe going to say more, but let me ask you instead, why is it better to make those small changes? Like you said that the smaller the changes you make, the bigger systems you can make them to. Why?
Because we have to be careful. Because in a system that doesn't fit in our head, especially one that's in JavaScript or Ruby or something where we don't have the compiler watching out for us quite as much as something like Elm. You don't know every impact of that change, and we're looking for surprises because surprises are learning, and changing and learning go hand in hand on a complex system. It's really hard to learn about it without changing it, and change is a process of learning, and you just want that learning to be as quick as possible. And sometimes what you'll learn is the deploy is broken. And then that's what you're going to focus on. It's just a matter of how soon can you find a surprise?
Yeah. I've worked on a lot of legacy projects in my career. And so that means that like when I apply a certain change, I don't know, and maybe I even can't know quite a lot of the time all the effects that that change might have. And so it's really scary to me, the idea of applying a big change all at once, because that might affect a whole bunch of stuff and create like a real problem that's really hard to recover from. And so if I apply a really small change, then I can apply the change, then try to observe. You know, you can't necessarily observe all the effects directly, but you can at least say, okay, did the site go down? Let me wait a day. Like, did something really horrible happen in the last 24 hours after I introduced this change? You can at least do that.
Yeah, you're kind of making your feature implementation into a process instead of a transaction. It's not all or nothing. It's a gradual move. G-Paw Hill has some great stuff about this, about thinking hard about how we make changes and how can we harvest the value of the change to help us make more changes. And he talks about how one of the value of making such a tiny change and then getting into production is that you get into this habit and this cycle of changing. And that in itself is valuable to help you make more changes smoothly. And just, you just kind of get on a roll.
Yeah. I'm having a little bit of an unrelated thought, which is it seems like programmers go through this kind of arc in their career where you start off as a total beginner and your confidence is low. Then you gain some confidence and you get, and you get overconfident.
Then you get dangerous. Yeah.
And then you get burned. And then you go back to being like, your confidence level is then appropriate.
Yeah, yeah. Then your confidence level is low for good reasons.
Yeah. Yeah, I don't know. Just wanted to share that thought.
Yeah, totally.
So our stated topic of the show, I think, thanks to me, we've discussed almost not at all. But maybe let's talk about this a little bit more. Can you maybe just like talk about some of your experiences working on big systems? Like, what were they and what did they do? My career, I've worked on like a lot of back office stuff where there's just like a handful of users. That doesn't mean the applications weren't very big, because sometimes they were. But I haven't worked on anything with like a whole bunch of users or anything like that. But I have worked on big code bases that did a lot of stuff. But I'm just curious, what's the nature of some of the big projects you've worked on?
Well, I could pull a couple examples. One of my favorites was this insurance system that it was big. And this would have been like 2009, somewhere around there. And the code was in a very 1999 style, and this was Java, so it made a big difference. The architect in charge, I called him the architect of doom, who was the only one allowed to merge to master, was very particular about his code standards and hadn't updated them in 10 years.
Mm-hmm.
I really didn't like to hear about that from me in particular. But
I've worked with people like that who like, they're very particular and they have terrible taste.
His taste was totally fine 10 years ago, but Java advanced and standards had advanced. And we have standard ORMs now, and we shouldn't still be on your custom one that doesn't work. But the beauty of it was so consistent. I really enjoyed digging into that system and figuring out how it worked, figuring out the hash tables of hash tables that cached the data per user, per insurance quote. It was wild. And the 16 levels of class inheritance was, I'm not exaggerating.
Wow.
So yeah, it was fascinating. But once I got my teeth around it, I knew how the entire thing worked because it was so consistent. And the other thing that made that system great was it had beautiful admin screens, because you could see what was cached for every user, for every insurance quote. And we shut it down every night to clear out the cache, because it would run out of its 32 gigs of memory with its 70 users.
Wow.
Right. But it's insurance. It's totally fine to shut it down every night.
Yeah.
Nobody's working. There's like a 9-hour window in two time zones that people are working, and that is it. So it's fun, like the constraints that that system didn't have, such as needing to stay up for more than 10 hours a day. And yeah, the consistency was beautiful. The admin screens were beautiful. And that system limped along longer than it had a right to because of that. But the trade-off was you couldn't maintain that consistency and grow. And I heard years later, they wound up eventually rewriting it in C sharp. Yeah. So there are total trade-offs mm-hmm. between the consistency and growth.
Advancement. Yeah, that's pretty interesting. And when you say grow, what do you mean by that?
Like maybe can we... There was an old pattern in Java where you would instantiate an object in order to instantiate one of those objects.
Okay.
Yeah, exactly. It was, there are historical reasons that that was sometimes a good idea. Those reasons like went away in Java 4 or 5, I think 4 or earlier. But because that was the standard in the code base, it remained the standard in the code base. So as the language grew, the code base didn't. And so it stayed inefficient. And more significantly, it got out of sync with the brains of modern Java developers.
Mm.
So when you have someone come in and they're like, what is this garbage? And it's not compatible with the people anymore because the rest of the world has moved on. So part of what I mean by growth is just staying relatively in sync with the outside world.
Do you think it hurts? I don't know why I'm phrasing this as a question. I think it hurts. I don't hear people talk about this too much, but when a project is a legacy project like that, and it's old and creaky and the code is messy and stuff like that, I think it hurts, the company's ability to recruit and hang on to good developers.
Oh, totally. Oh, yeah. That was one of the best teams I ever worked on as far as the people. They hired a bunch of us right at a downturn. So they got us cheap. It was one of the best teams I've ever been on. Fantastic people. And we were all gone within a year and a half.
Oh, man.
Yeah.
Yeah.
We learned a lot, though. As far as like my personal development, one of the best jobs I ever had. But yeah, they couldn't hang on to us because when you've got someone who is excited about the work, who is enthusiastic about learning, and you tell them not to learn, keep working in this old way for consistency's sake, yeah, you're going to lose them at best. At worst, you're going to destroy them.
Yeah. Yeah, that's tough. You said you learned a lot at that job.
Yeah, it was great for me.
What did you learn? I've actually found that like when I'm working on a legacy project, it often is a great impediment to learning because you're so like straitjacketed by how crappy the code is and you have to be really conservative about the changes and stuff like that. So what kind of stuff did you learn on that project?
Well, what I learned from the other people on the team. It wasn't from the code much. I learned from the people. And we had a group that really did want to make the system better and to do a great job. So we asked for a conference room that we could use as a team room. And we chose to pair program. And we had... an expert in Agile who was ridiculously overqualified, but decided he wanted to do a year of development. This was Steve Stamps. He's awesome. And he taught us Agile and extreme programming. And I learned about teamwork. And it was the perfect place to learn about teamwork because we had squashing pressure from the outside that gave us kind of a common thing to fight against. We kind of came together against the architect of doom. And that made
Wait, can you just Can you just real briefly talk about why was this Architect of Doom the Architect of Doom?
Well, he had complete ownership of the code base, and only he could merge to master. So you had to get your code past his code review if you wanted to get anything out. So he liked his salary, and he wanted to remain important and essential to the business despite being an asshole. And he was very effective at it because he wouldn't let us come to the meetings with the customers. He knew the business domain of this particular kind of insurance inside and out. And as such, he was incredibly valuable because that's the hard knowledge to acquire. Anything about Java or DB2 or any of the other tools, I could look up online. But that business domain, that's the special sauce that's particular to this company. And he kept a stranglehold on that.
Oh, wow. That's really interesting. There's some analogy there, like about, there's some kind of like economic analogy about a monopoly or something maybe, but that's really interesting that he like blocked everybody else from learning the stuff that it's like he wasn't remaining valuable by actually being a really good employee and by being super valuable. He was remaining valuable by trying to make everybody else less valuable.
Yeah. I mean, he was valuable because he did learn the business domain, but he kept a monopoly on that. Yeah. Which as a result decreased the value of the system and team as a whole.
All right. Well, it's getting close to time to start winding down the episode. I'm going to ask you one more question, that doesn't have anything to do with anything. But I'm curious, and you can answer this question as long or as short as you want to. I gather that you've spoken at a lot of conferences. I started speaking at conferences in like late 2018. I accidentally hit it way too hard. I spoke at like 9 conferences in 12 months or something like that. Way too much travel, but it was a lot of fun. And I went to some really cool places and stuff like that. I'm just kind of curious about your conference speaking experience. Particularly, I'm curious. I saw like an interview with you in Spain, and that was probably pretty cool to go to a conference in Spain. So my general question is, can you tell us about your conference speaking experience? And my specific question is, where are some of the places you've gone in the world that have been some of your favorite places?
Favorite places. I love Poland. GeekCon in Krakow, I recommend that one.
What did you like about Poland?
Oh, people are so nice. And Krakow in particular was not bombed in World War II, so it's really old and it's got so many beautiful buildings. It's just really friendly. Lots of really smart developers over there. And if you speak, if you like make some feeble attempt to speak Polish, they love it.
Okay.
It's like appreciated. They don't look down on you for speaking Polish badly, which made me happy.
Mm-hmm.
I love Australia. I did Yao, which was Sydney, Melbourne, and Brisbane. That's a blast.
What did you like about Australia?
Well, Australia, it's a lot like the U.S., except they have better coffee and better weather.
Mm.
Okay. And they drive on the wrong side. It's all about the people, right?
Yeah, that's definitely the case. And I love traveling for conferences, or like sometimes I almost like business travel more than vacation travel, because when you're traveling for business or a conference, you like have a reason to interact with people there. And it's meet people and stuff. Yeah.
Travel can be boring if it's like for work and you like travel to an office and everybody else works there and you're the only one having dinner by yourself. That can be, but conferences are fantastic because everyone is there to meet people and to talk about programming or related things, or unrelated things to programmers. And that is a blast. It's a different place every time. The hotels are actually nice. Yeah, GoTo and QCon, those are great conferences.
Is there like a certain number of conferences per year you shoot for speaking at or anything like that?
I try to keep it under 12 and I fail.
Yeah. And like, so when I've done it, like I've funded myself and that's, you know, that gets expensive pretty quick. Some people, like their employer pays for it and stuff like that. How do you manage that part of it?
Well, if I'm speaking about something about like my work, then my employer will pay for it. Yeah, my last job, Adamus paid me paid for my travel for a bunch of conferences that they wanted me to go to. But in general, I only go to conferences that pay.
Yeah. And that's another challenge that I had with the conference speaking is the spousal jealousy. You know, I would go to all these cool places and then like, you know, my wife would be jealous. And also I would feel kind of bad for.
Well, you know, that's interesting because my husband is not really interested in leaving the house that much. And I don't understand it, but I guess I should be grateful because he's not jealous. He doesn't want to hop on a plane and go to Philly this week and San Francisco next week. And I totally do.
But that's also the advantage of like, I spoke at a conference in Omaha and my wife is like, I don't want to go to Omaha. And I'm like, all right, this one is free. Oh, and lastly, okay, this is the very last question I'll ask you. I think I saw that you tweeted that you recently like became an independent consultant or something like that. Am I remembering that right?
I am headed in that direction, I think.
Okay.
Yeah, we'll see.
Do you want to talk about that at all?
At the moment, I am free to explore whatever opportunities are around. And I have a theory that people ask me, what do you want to do next? And I'm like, okay, I have learned wanting is overrated because if you like envision the thing that you want and you go for it, you are missing out on so much in the universe that you personally never imagined.
Yeah.
So I'm all for seeing what's in front of me and picking the option that I'm going to learn the most or that's going to open the most future opportunities or that. And this is me at conferences. I go to so many because I get invited. And I mean, why wouldn't I go? Well, okay, I'll tell you why I wouldn't go. It's because I can't do 30 conferences a year. But it did start out with, if they invited me, I would go. And so I learned unexpected things. Like that conference in Spain was a conference on big data and DevOps. And I haven't gone to any big data conferences, so I get to meet a new set of people. I've been at Ruby conferences, Elixir conferences, JavaScript conferences, lots of the general conferences like go to, and I've been to .NET conferences, and I meet different people at all of them, and that's really cool. And if you had sat me down and said, what kind of conferences do you want to speak at? I would have said, and I would have had to answer from the things that I already knew. How boring is that?
Yeah, I think there's definitely some wisdom in that. One of the most frustrating things I see in like freelancing advice and consulting advice is like describe your ideal client as one of the first steps. And it's like nobody who became a successful consultant started that way and arrived that way. They got there by like experiencing things and like stumbling into things. Mm-hmm. And like, I think most people who have gotten somewhere, like they never set out to go exactly to that place.
That's the thing. The combination of us interacting with the world is more powerful than our imagination by itself.
Agreed. Okay. I said that was my last question. So that will be my last question. Before we go, where can people find you online and all that stuff?
I'm Jessitron on Twitter, Jessitron. You can also find my blog at blog.jessitron.com. That's about it.
All right. Well, dear listener, be sure to check those links out and we'll put them in the show notes. Jessica, thanks so much for coming on the show.
Thank you, Jason. This was fun talking to you.